chicken your favourite late January gift. If you are listening to this message, I am lost in a garden centre with the Christmas sale paraphernalia, cotton traders zip-up fleeces, and a magic mitt that can clean any surface for the low, low price of £29.99. Today we are going to discuss the science of one thing that this particular garden centre doesn't appear to sell. Plants. What are they? Are there some behind the light-up Rottweiler babbling fountains? We can only hope to find out. Dada. We shall begin by investigating the different ways in which plants can produce electricity. I would do this by going on a trip to a power plant, but they would not let me in. Photosynthesis creates some electrical energy, which the plant stores as potential or chemical energy in the form of glucose. The energy comes from the sun, and plants are almost 100% efficient at converting this energy into electricity, a significantly higher percentage than that of solar panels. We cannot compare. A place of interest for research into bioelectricity is the Istituto Italiano di Tecnologia, where they have managed to generate electricity from leaves by taking advantage of the properties of the leaf structure. Now, a leaf consists of two firm layers called cuticles, separated by a cellular membrane. The cuticles act as dielectrics, that is to say that they maintain opposite charges. The charges are immobile and they are separated from each other. On either side of the dielectric material, you have positive charges on one side of the cuticle and negative charges on the other side. This charge separation is induced by touching the leaf with another material that has dielectric properties. Like energy, charge gets conserved, meaning that the starting net charge in the system, in this case zero, must match the ending net charge. While the material and the leaf are in contact, the net charge cancels out at the surface due to the charges on the touching material. However, when that touching material is now not in contact with the leaf, it is removed. The positive charges on the cuticle get cancelled out by the induction of mobile charges within the leaf tissue layer underneath. And if there's charges moving about in the leaf tissue, that means there's an electrical current flowing in it.
Wow.
By harnessing this, the researchers were able to charge a capacitor and illuminate 100 LEDs using one rhododendron leaf. It was found that the material that you touch the leaf with has an impact on the voltage you get out. The more chemically similar the stimulating material to the leaf, the lower the output voltage. The lowest voltage is therefore achieved by touching the rhododendron leaf with another leaf of the same species. It has to be of the same species because it gets that specific. If you use a different species of leaf, you get a higher voltage than you would if you used the same species. Rhododendron was used in this experiment because you can take cuttings from the plant, so it won't just die when you take the leaf off the parent plant. Taking cuttings is like you could cut a leaf off the plant and then stick it in the ground and then it will start growing and get another rhododendron. Woo! If the leaf gets too dead and dried out, then the charges can't move in the leaf tissue and it's all very sad. So how do you get electricity out of a plant that has died? Well, the answer to that one is biomass, which you can get electricity out of by just setting it on fire. Biomass takes the form of pellets made from the waste from the timber trade, such as flakes of tree, or wonky trees, or perfectly fine trees, which are a bit small. I mean, it's more renewable than fossil fuels, but the net carbon dioxide release in comparison to traditional coal-fired power stations is debatable. There's a power station in North Yorkshire which uses biomass to produce 12% of the entire UK's renewable electricity output. To do this, it consumes 62,000 tonnes of wood pellets every 2.5 days. That's about 413 blue whales. Or one net weight of fish caught by Icelandic fishing vessels in June 2020 alone. But that unit name isn't quite as catchy. The electrical properties of plants can also be used for something a bit more eclectic. The electrical conductivity of the surface of a leaf changes with the variations in the environment around it, such as changing light levels. These variations can be converted to signals which can be used to control changes in pitch in a synthesizer, for instance, or other musical instruments. We unfortunately have no performers here tonight. What a shame. I said we have no performers here tonight. Oh, all right. I'll let you introduce everyone to the next section. Dearest friends, we shall now move on to plants in space.
My roots curl strongly to the ground, but some say humans get to fly around. I'd like to join the humans in the stars someday. If I like to fly under me, I'd burn away. I was tempted leaning on the safety of the known. Out there they say a tree cannot survive on its own. A human's like a plant as it grows and learns. In safety, seek or misery or happiness that burns.
Oh, that was lovely. Don't crack your face, will you? So, what would you want to grow a plant in space for, then? Well, if you've ever seen the little dried packets of astronaut food that they sell in a science museum gift shop, it won't be too much of a leap to work out that that's not going to work long term. Apart from being disgusting, the vitamins in the food break down, meaning that it won't even be any good for the astronauts. A crucial step towards long-term space flight and space exploration is therefore finding a way to get delicious leaves on tap. Determining whether any sort of plant or life at all would survive in space goes all the way back to 1946, when America's National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics launched a V-2 rocket containing seeds to 83 miles above the Earth's surface. Although these seeds were not recovered, a sample of maize seeds, launched 21 days later on the 30th of July 1946, returned to Earth in one piece. This organisation would go on to become NASA, who would conduct various experiments over the years, testing and developing ways to grow plants in space. Also doing this were the Soviet space programme, who took their system OASIS 1 on the first ever space station in 1971. They grew flax, leek, onion and Chinese cabbage in OASIS 1. A later generation of the OASIS growing system, OASIS 1M, provided two cosmonauts with the first space-grown vegetables to be eaten in space in 1975, apparently. It might have been better than dehydrated space food, but space fairies can't survive on onions alone, which is what they eat, by the way. Other plants they grew included the peas, radishes, lettuce, garlic, cucumbers, parsley and dill cultivated on the sixth generation of the Soviet space station, Salyut 6. Disclaimer. Reading up on the history of living organisms in space is destined to become a lot easier, since instead of trying to keep track of the achievements of an entire government space agency posturing and all the politics of that, we'll just have to keep track of two white men with a combined wealth of over the GDP of Denmark, swings and burning roundabouts, war tunnels and drones. The pull of gravity guides a plant's roots down into the ground, so what happens when the fun of orbit means that the plant experiences no gravitational force? Well, the plant can also rely on finding the position of a light source to know which way up it's supposed to be. NASA's plant growing system, named Veggie, has an array of LEDs which mimic sunlight, albeit with less green wavelengths, to ensure that the plants absorb as much light as possible. This is because you may have noticed most plants reflect green light, which you will know if an image of a plant has ever been incident on your eyeballs. It also means that the plant growing station glows a fetching shade of magenta. This apparatus has also been used to grow mustard, lentils, radishes, romaine lettuce, pak choi, wasabi, and zinnias. Talking of zinnias, it'd be a bit nice if we could learn a bit more about some lovely flowers. That'd be really nice. If you've listened to the flight episode, you'll know that flowering plants first appeared in the Cretaceous period. Evolution has been busy since then, producing a wide range of flowers, both pleasant and unpleasant. Amongst other colours, nasturtiums can have red flowers with 5 petals. The flowers, along with all parts of the plant apart from the root, are completely edible. They add a delicious peppery flavour to salads, which will leave you feeling alive. Amongst other colours, oleanders can have red flowers with 5 petals. The flowers, along with all parts of plant apart from the root, are completely inedible. They add a disgusting bitter flavour to salads, which will leave you unable to feel any living emotion ever again. Such is the danger we must deal with when investigating flowering plants. Oddly enough, nasturtium is not the Latin name of the flower we are referring to. Botanically, nasturtium refers to a family of edible watercresses which are not closely related to the flower at all, but they have a similar taste. It's a bit like renaming 1p coins blood and expecting everyone to just be fine with it. I know I'm not. While oleanders and nasturtiums are not related to one another, there is a certain family of flowering plants with an equally wide-ranging potential for danger. Solanaceae is a family which contains potatoes, tobacco, chili peppers, deadly nightshade, mandrakes, and tomatoes, and more. Chemically, they contain a variety of alkaloids whose effects on humans and other animals range from the heat of the capsaicin in chili peppers to the addiction of nicotine, which, by the way, is not just found in tobacco, but in aubergines, potatoes, and tomatoes. This is not an explanation for Pringles' famous slogan, since potatoes barely contain any nicotine and Pringles barely contain any potato. Now, there are 3 fates in Greek mythology, stay with me here. One spun the thread of life, one drew the thread out, and the third cut the thread short. The third is named Atropos, who lends her name to tropanes, a family of alkaloids that do exactly that. But not before inducing hallucination or maybe putting you in a coma. However, in smaller doses, tropanes can have more useful effects, such as alleviating poisoning due to certain types of insecticide and nerve agent. Types of tropane include scopolamine, which is used in small doses to combat motion sickness and the nausea induced by chemotherapy. A common side effect of tropanes is dilation of the pupils. They are the reason that fashionable Renaissance ladies used to put deadly nightshade in their eyes, creating a doe-eyed look that may end up permanent if you dosed too heavily. Henbane is another member of the Solanaceae family that gained fame for its association with women. Unfortunately, this association revolved around witchcraft. This may be down to it being used as a herbal remedy for toothache, rheumatism, and bone ailment. But of course, certain people used it wrong and started like seeing things and experiencing aphrodisiac effects. If your doctor gave you dextroamphetamines for your ADHD and you had too many, it meant you couldn't urinate properly, what would you do? Right, you have 2 options here. One is to accept that you need to calm down and stop taking so many. Or I suppose the only other option is to just tie your doctor to a chair and chuck him in a river. And then hang him if he survives. I mean, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Maybe accept that I was wrong about something or prick him with the testing stick to see if he did cavort with the evil one's teeth. This week was supposed to be about flowers. It was supposed to be about lovely, pretty flowers.
I'm quite possibly the first person in history to be forcibly escorted from a garden centre for disruptive behaviour. The only place that I could think of to escape from the shame of this accolade is a deep, deep underground bunker. Yes, next episode we're going underground. See you there.
Oh, get over it! It was 400 years ago! I will not! Those are women in STEM that were burned, they were. It's rude!